Good evening. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM on Alaska, and this is The Exchange for Thursday, June 6th. I'm Alexandra Gutierrez. This week marks the 70th anniversary of the Battle of Dutch Harbor. It's one of the few attacks on American soil in modern history, but largely overlooked by people outside of Alaska. With us today, we have local teacher and historian Jeff Dickrell. He's the author of Center of the Storm, a book that focuses on the attack, and he's here to explain what exactly happened. Thanks for joining us.
More than welcome.
Just starting off, for people who aren't familiar with what happened here during World War II, can you just kind of give us a broad sketch of what happened during the battle?
June 3rd and 4th, 1942, the Japanese bombed Dutch Harbor in a ongoing campaign of trying to take over the Pacific and push the Americans back. So it's kind of a big milestone.
Mm-hmm. Why was there a base out here in the first place?
That's a good question, actually. Interestingly, a treaty signed between Japan and the United States banned, in 1922, banned all military fortifications of the Aleutian Islands and also some Japanese islands. And in the mid-1930s, the Japanese repudiated the treaty, which allowed the Americans to start fortifying Alaska. And I got to remember, this is the Great Depression, and the buildup to war was happening. So everybody recognized the need. So they began to make a strategic plan for Alaska. And Dutch Harbor was one of the bases that was built. Sitka, Kodiak, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Yakutat was planned as a base. And so out here in this sleepy little village, which was based mainly on cod fishing at the time and herring, you had the town of Unalaska with about 500 people, mainly Unungan, and Dutch Harbor, which was a fueling stop run by the North American Commercial Company. Very run down, few buildings, less than 10 people on the Dutch Harbor side. But the Navy had set up a weather station out there. So they owned a little bit of land. And the decision to build a base in Dutch Harbor was based on the fact that they owned a little bit of land. It's a very good harbor. And this is in the mid-1930s, late 30s, before airplanes were important. And we'll talk a little bit about that, a little more about airplanes in a minute. But this looked like an ideal base. So in 1938, they allocated the money. And in 1940, they began construction, mainly using civilian construction crews. And they started building on the Dutch Harbor side, the naval base over there. And eventually it grew into quite a sizable installation.
Mm-hmm. When you say sizable, could you be a little bit more specific?
Sure. Well, whenever the Navy builds a base, the Army has to build a corresponding base to defend it. So you had the naval operating base of Dutch Harbor, and then you had the Army Fort Mears, which is located where the Grand Aleutian and the Safeway and Alaska Ship had almost 1,000 buildings, all made of wood in that flat area there, to defend against enemy attacks on the Navy base. He also had an installation up on top of Ballyhoo with some pretty big cannons up there. Grand total time of the bombing is kind of iffy, but it's about 10,000 guys.
Could you sort of talk a little bit about the buildup to the bombing?
One of the interesting things I find about the buildup is that because two weird factors, because Dutch Harbor is considered part of the continental United States, it was built as a continental United States base, which meant you had toilets and, electricity and plumbing were some of the major components of the base. They made it not, it was not a remote base. It wasn't a defensive base. It was a base to house people. So you have a little bit more permanent style structures than you would have in a, in a remote jungle outpost somewhere. So they built roads, they built plumbing, they built telephones, telephone infrastructure, electricity, generator buildings, all that good stuff on a place that had nothing, essentially. So that was a huge deal. And the other thing I find interesting, and I think people will understand this coming from here, is that as they were building, airplanes became a prominent feature in warfare, and so they had to figure out a way to build a runway. However, there is nowhere to build a runway in the Unalaska Dutch Harbor area. There's no flat ground with long approaches. The only decent spot that would have been super suitable was the actual town site of Unalaska. And when a proposal was put out there to bulldoze the entire town and build a runway right where the church and everything is, that is when the townsfolk got motivated and incorporated as an official Class A city or whatever the designation was. So that's an important step government-wise. And the compromise for that was that they built two air bases in secret, one in Cold Bay that most of us are familiar with. And they had a 10,000-foot runway there, a very large bomber strip. And then to the west of us, about 60, 70 miles on Fort Glenn on Umnak, where another flat spot allowed a big air base to be built. But nothing here.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit about sort of what was the strategic value of this base out here? And that's why it was, you know, a good target for the Japanese.
That's actually a really good question, and it brings up one of my favorite quotes. For people who are interested in all things aviation or militarily, back in the 1920s, an American army guy, I think he was a colonel at the time, but he later becomes General Billy Mitchell, he started looking at airplanes as the new weapon, and he has a very famous quote that he did in the 1920s, and he said, "He who owns Alaska controls the world." And so if you look at the globe from an airplane, you know, view, Alaska becomes very important. But, of course, Dutch Harbor sits on the Great Circle Route, so we are absolutely equidistant. If you go from San Francisco to Tokyo, we are actually within a few miles of being dead center. That's one of the reasons why we're such a big transport hub, is because we go within 200 miles of the Great Circle Route. So this was a natural place to build a base. However, in 1938, they tried some maneuvers up here and found out that the weather was so bad that they said, we don't have to worry about it too much because you can't have a military operation. So there was a very small base. You had a base about 1,000 miles south in Midway, which was a very large base and much more important to protect Hawaii. But most of the reason was because we are theoretically on the route.
And could you talk a little bit about the advance of the Japanese on the Aleutians?
Sure. It's hard to believe today that if you'd have gone back 70 years and 70 years, 6 months, right after the Pearl Harbor attacks on December the 7th, 41, the Japanese had basically 6 months of undefeated, lightning-fast conquering of all of South Asia, basically every island from Australia to the mainland. With a few exceptions, they had taken over the Indonesian islands, they had taken over Vietnam, they had taken over Guam, they had taken over the Philippines, and just one after the other. And they were in a very cocky mode, and they wanted to push their perimeter back further, and they looked out to where the Americans were, and they had a big base on Midway, which protected Hawaii, and they had a base in Dutch Harbor. So they figured if they could at least damage those and take them out of commission, that they could extend their perimeter a bit further out. There is a spurious theory out there where the main attack was going for Midway and that Dutch Harbor was just a diversion. And if you read most history books, that's what they will tell you. But documentation on that was found after the war that they weren't going to fake Dutch Harbor and then go for Midway. They just thought they were strong enough to hit both of them at the same time.
In the period between the attack on Pearl Harbor and the attack on Dutch Harbor, can you tell me a little bit about what, you know, Americans of the lower 48 were thinking about Alaska and sort of what the climate was down there?
My father talked about it. He was in high school, and basically everybody thought the Japanese would show up on the shores of Los Angeles at any given time, especially with the air power, which they pretty much invented. So people were in panic mode. Hawaii was turned into an armed camp. They started camouflaging and blacking out places on the West Coast because the Japanese were so dominant. They just, wherever they wanted to, they would pick a spot and conquer it within a few days or weeks.
So we've talked a lot about the buildup to the attack. Can you sort of, you know, describe what happened with the attack?
The decision to bomb Dutch Harbor and Midway was made in late April, early May. One of the interesting things of this whole story is that the Americans had broken the Japanese code. They knew about the attacks. But you, if you've broken somebody's code, you can't let them know by defending exactly what they're going to do. So they had to, they let a few things happen, and but they put Dutch Harbor on the alert and said, you will be attacked sometime in the end of May. So that put a little heat under the Dutch Harbor folks. And I do keep saying Dutch Harbor because I know there's some out there who, you know, try to correct us on Alaska, but this all happened on the Dutch Harbor side. And the Dutch Harbor side, the buildup, they were working 24-7, digging trenches, digging machine gun pits, bomb shelters, stockpiling supplies, and basically getting ready for an invasion they assumed was coming any day. So on the early morning of June 3rd, a flight of planes flew over on Alaska, Dutch Harbor. Everybody looked up. Remember, these were 18, 20-year-old, mainly National Guard guys from Arkansas and California. Most had never fired their weapons. None had fired their weapons in anger. They looked up and saw 16 black dots flying over in formation and just assumed it was American planes. Of course, there would have been planes flying over all the time. The Japanese circled over at about 6 in the morning, took photographs of the whole island, and then the bombs began to fall. The highest concentration of buildings was right where the Grand Aleutian is today in Safeway, and the first string of bombs fell right through there, killed a number of men, and then set some fires going. And slowly, through the course of the next less than an hour, the Japanese just looked down. Their goal was to find an airfield to bomb, but we didn't have one here. So they just bombed targets of opportunity. Probably the most famous story that comes out of that is that a guy was in the radio shack telling Seattle that they were under attack using the telegraph machine. And as he was telegraphing, Seattle telegraphed back and said, are you joking? Is this a drill? Which it echoed the famous story of Pearl Harbor being bombed. This is no drill. The radio guy in Dutch Harbor Radio Shack typed down to Seattle, we're being bombed. Seattle responded and said, is this a drill? Just as a string of four bombs surrounded his building, and he famously typed out, that one knocked me off my chair. So the Seattle knew. They had a direct cable right down to Seattle, and so they knew that they were under attack. For the next 20 minutes or so, Japanese planes flew over, shot the place up with machine guns, dropped a few more bombs. Not a lot of damage. The Japanese didn't really know what they were up against. And so after about 40 minutes total, the 20 or so Japanese planes flew back to their carriers, which were about 180 miles southwest of here, and started to steam off towards Adak, where they assumed there was another base. They sent some planes over Adak and found out that we had not occupied Adak at all, turned back towards Dutch Harbor, fatefully. So on the night of the evening of June 4th, about 30 Japanese planes came back over. The men were basically ready for anything. They assumed the Japanese fleet was going to roll into Iliuliuk Harbor. And they looked up at the planes. They immediately started firing. The Japanese planes, in this case, had looked at the photographs, identified some targets that they would rather hit since there was no airfield here. The first bomb was dropped on Haystack Hill, narrowly missing the top of the hill and blowing up a hospital, a private hospital, right down by Alyeska, where it is today. And then in quick succession, in as far as I can tell from the photographs, within about 15 seconds, they hit a fuel tank over where APL fuel tanks are, which exploded in a giant column of smoke. They put a bomb through the Delta Western fuel dock, and they hit a ship that was tied up right in front of the powerhouse. Three bombs in about 15 seconds, and each one of those created a giant fire. So you had giant plumes of black oily smoke and white smoke from burning wood, and pretty much made the whole world look like some major damage had been done. The reality was very little damage had been done, but most of the guys that I had talked to, most of the vets, thought the world was ending at that point. The Japanese planes spent about 40 minutes overhead, dropped a few more bombs. Casualties were pretty minor in the big picture at the end of the two-day bombing. About 70 guys were killed. Not a lot of damage was done. A few buildings, the oil tank. But all in all, everything was intact. So it was a very minor attack on one level, but it let the Americans know that they could be touched out here, and that had the Japanese wanted to, they probably could have rolled this place up.
You talked a little bit about the capability of the Japanese Air Force. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that?
There was always a little bit of racism involved in this time period. And when the Japanese started to develop modern weaponry, they took the best of the Western powers and incorporated it into their planes, and then kind of took it one step further. One of the very famous things that they did is they looked at a young man named Howard Hughes, who had developed a technology of riveting planes together, but instead of having little bumps on the end of the rivets, he would have the rivets flat, flush. And this increased the speed of the planes immensely. No other Western power used that technology, but the Japanese saw it and grabbed it and stuck with it. When they attacked Dutch Harbor, their planes were far and above the technology that we had, which when you're fighting one-on-one is very important. And we had no idea. So our anti-aircraft guns couldn't shoot at their planes because they were moving too fast. We didn't have accurate speed deducers so that we couldn't predict time and places of where they were going to be and again, shoot at them accurately. So it was kind of a godsend that one of the planes from Dutch Harbor was that was attacking Dutch Harbor had been shot in the oil cooler and crash-landed on an island about 30 miles away, Akutan, and was recovered about a month after the attacks. It was seen by some air crews. They took a boat over with a bulldozer, brought the plane back. It was in workable condition. They took it down to San Diego and reflew it and discovered all sorts of weaknesses and strengths of it. But most people today, if you ask them about the Aleutian campaign, that was probably the most important thing.
We were talking about how powerful these airplanes are and how the American military just couldn't really match them. What did the American military really do right in terms of the Aleutian campaign?
That's a great question, because right up until the bombings, not much. They made about every mistake a military could. They concentrated their housing units so that when the first bombs fell, killed 25 guys because they were all packed together. They did not have adequate air protection. The communications with Cold Bay and Fort Glenn failed during the bombings. They had no backup plan. They had no defensive plan if the Japanese had invaded. They didn't have any sort of fortifications and not even a plan. Several people told me that they basically, the veterans who were here, they went to the mess halls, grabbed as much food as they could, and then drove as far as they could. And in one case, one guy said, "I just left the Jeep running and ran up into the hills because with all the food I could carry, because I thought that the Japanese were right on our heels." But the one thing we did do right was we did build those airfields in absolute secrecy so that the Japanese had no idea that they were there. Either one, so they were very surprised that when, at the end of the attacks, when the Americans did find them, that there were airplanes up here because they didn't know where they could have come from. They did capture one downed air crew, and the only reason they let them live was to interrogate them about where the airplanes came from. That's kind of interesting.
So what happened to the population that was out here when World War II started? You know, most people are familiar with the evacuations that happened, but could you kind of explain how that policy decision was made and how that impacted the people out here?
How that policy decision was made is a puzzle. Dean Kirchhoffer wrote a great book called The Wind Is Not a River, where he tried to find the actual documentation on it. And it was basically the decision was made to evacuate them. Where to evacuate them was never figured out. The Navy wanted to put them over in the Shumigin Sandpoint and on the peninsula, King Cove, where they had family and they knew their way around. But the Japanese bombing kind of changed all of that. So they shoved them down in the southeast. You had about six different government entities. So you had the Bureau of Indian Affairs was kind of the government agency in charge of the people in the Aleutians. But you had Fish and Wildlife Administration was in charge of the people in the Pribilofs. Most of the people from the Aleutian chain itself were fairly well housed and were in close enough proximity to small towns that they could get jobs in them. A few of them stayed down in Ketchikan or Juneau, Wrangell. But the Pribilovians, because they were under the Fish and Wildlife, were treated the worst and were put in the abandoned canneries, and they suffered, you know, a lot. But as far as the actual decision, the Navy said, get these, you know, get these civilians out of the harm's way, whereas the white people were allowed to stay. And then Fish and Wildlife, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Navy, the Department of the Interior all had a hand in screwing it up, I guess, for lack of a better term. And then, interestingly, when the people returned, some of the more remote villages in Unalaska, Borka and Makushin and Kashiga, the government, federal government said, we are not going to allow you to resettle those places. We won't give you money for schools. We won't deliver the mail. We won't provide any services whatsoever. You can move there if you want, but we're not going to help you out in any way. And so those towns died as a result of that.
How did this attack change the direction of World War II, if it had any sort of substantial impact? How does this sort of fit into the larger picture of the way the war turned out?
That's a great question, because it allows me to do my second favorite quote after Billy Mitchell's "He Who Controls Alaska Controls the World." The Navy's official historian Samuel Elliott Morrison, at the end of his chapter on the Aleutians, said, "It would have been better to have left the Aleutians to the Aleuts." And what he means by that is, after the bombing of Dutch Harbor, the Japanese take over two islands at the end of the chain, Attu and Kiska. They set up small garrisons there. They capture 42 Aleuts from Attu, take them back to Japan. They have about 2,000 guys on Attu. They have about 10,000 guys on Kiska. They start to build an airfield by hand, unlike the Americans. And we spend the next year building bases closer and closer to them. So we build Adak, we build Atka, we build one on Amchitka and Shemya, in order, because the weather's so bad, in order to try to bomb them off, you had to build bases closer and closer. Then after 1943, after we invade those two islands and remove the Japanese threat from here, basically the Aleutians gets not abandoned, but is a huge backwater. There's a few bombing missions when the weather permits, which is almost never, to bomb the northern islands. But basically about 30,000 guys sat here for 2 years and did nothing.
And so obviously the attack on Dutch Harbor was not considered a major turning point in the war. Otherwise, there would be popular knowledge of it, which there doesn't
Correct.
Seem to be.
Correct.
But it obviously is hugely important to those of us who live here in terms of, you know, the region's development and, you know, the development of our own community.
Sure.
Can you talk about how this attack set the stage for the development of our community today?
Yeah, you know, of course, it's only speculative, but if you took pre-war Unalaska, Dutch Harbor was just a few buildings. If you took pre-war Unalaska and tried to make it into a major seafood processing hub, you would have no infrastructure, including no airport. So you would have to build everything from scratch. So when you're starting out in the 60s and you start to have a little bit of crab processing up here, you would have had no water system. There would have been nothing on the Dutch Harbor side for them to start. And they needed that to start. And they housed people in old buildings. And they used old, you know, the runway, and they used the old roads and everything. But mainly, of course, it's the water and the electrical systems that allowed us to become a seafood processing thing. That allows us to get a kickstart so that when oil money floods the state in the 79-80, the first thing that we did here was refurbish the water system.
So I guess for residents who want to get a sense of, you know, what being here was like in the early 1940s, which sites would you recommend they visit this week?
Well, of course, we always want to talk about the museum, both museums. The Museum of the Aleutians has a great Kiska exhibit up. They went out to Kiska and did a very comprehensive survey of all the Japanese military equipment out there. We have the World War II Visitor Center, which is a very interesting concept, for lack of a better term. I like to go above the airport and just look down, and you can see the big dugouts, revetments that you could put individual airplanes in. The old powerhouse, if you go above the powerhouse, the old one, has some anti-aircraft bunkers on the top. Just walking around Standard Oil Hill, of course, and the trenches above the post office on the other side are kind of cool. The gun positions on Bunker Hill are kind of cool. Yalakta Head is interesting to me because you can see the old gun positions that were built on top of for the new gun positions. So that's kind of cool to me. There's a secret place that I'll tell you about. You have a worldwide exclusive for a secret place. If you go to the World War II Center by the airport and walk directly across the street next to the fire station, there's a big grass hump. And in the middle of that grass hump, there is a hand-welded tripod for a 50 caliber machine gun that they were so panicky that they had the welders, instead of building stuff, were making tripods for anti-aircraft guns. And near as I can tell from that machine gun post, a guy named Dutch Schultz probably shot the Zero down.
Well, thanks so much for sharing that and for coming on. It was great having you.
My pleasure.
That was Jeff Dickrell, a history teacher at the Unalaska City School and author of Center of the Storm. I'm Alexandra Gutierrez, and that's it for this episode of The Exchange. Have a great evening, and thanks for listening.